Welcome to episode 348 of the Spokesman Cycling Podcast. This show was engineered on Sunday, 10th of February, 2024.
The Spokesman Cycling Roundtable Podcast is brought to you by Turn Bicycles. The good people at Turn are committed to building bikes that are useful enough to ride every day and dependable enough to carry the people you love. In other words, they make the kind of bikes that they want to ride. Turn has e-bikes for every type of rider, whether you're commuting, taking your kids to school, or even carrying another adult. Visit www.turnbicycles.com, that's T-E-R-N, bicycles.com, to learn more.
I'm Carlton Reed, and this is the fourth in a five-part series digging into bike navigation apps. There have been shows with folks from Ride with GPS, Bike Map, Cycle.Travel, and today it's the turn of Komoot, K-O-M-O-O-T. Although, as you'll soon hear in this nearly 90-minute chat with Jonathan Kamskard-Bennett, we also talk a great deal about travelling the world by bike. And that's before, of course, there were smartphone apps to guide you. Jonathan, welcome to the show. And presumably you're in London.
I am. Thank you very much for having me. It's a real pleasure. And yeah, I'm in London, South London to be precise, on a very beautiful, sunny February morning.
It's kind of nice in Newcastle as well, so we're blessed. Now, the reason I said that was because, A, your name, so we can discuss that in a second, and you can show me how you, or you can tell me how to pronounce your the Danish part of your name correctly, but also because we're talking here about Komoot, and Komoot is a German company. But first of all, how do I pronounce your name? Correctly.
So my name is pronounced Jonathan Kamskard-Bennett. And it's actually not a Danish surname. It's a Faroese surname from the Faroe Islands. So I am half British. My father's English. My mother is Danish. But my mother is half Faroese. My grandmother's from the Faroe Islands. And the Faroe Islands, for anyone listening who isn't sure exactly where they are, is a bunch of islands about halfway between Scotland and Iceland. And on the southernmost of those islands, called Suru, there's a kind of like a mountain ridge behind a village where like my gran and her family are from, called Kamskjær, and that's where that name is from. So yeah, it's Faroese surname via Denmark.
Wow. Okay. Good explanation. and because I didn't know any of that, I then didn't go back and check on your, because you're a global world crossing cyclist. So I noticed that you went from Iceland. Did you go via the Faroe Islands at all?
Yeah, so many years ago now, I spent 3 years cycling around the world, which was a whole kind of story and episode in itself. And at the very end of that, I wanted to go and see, because my great grandmother was still alive at the time, and she was alive and kicking the Faroes. So towards the end of this 3 year journey, I really wanted to go to Iceland and cycle there. It wasn't particularly advisable in the depths of winter, but I had a wonderful time nonetheless. And from there, you can take a ferry to the Faroes. So I did go. I did, after sort of not really seeing any family for about 3 years, I did go and see my great grandmother, which was amazing. It's an incredibly beautiful place. By that point, I had seen an awful lot of the world, and the Faroes, you know, just like truly spectacular. And it was really wonderful that I got to go and see my great grand, because she actually passed away a few months later. So it was all kind of perfect, a really nice kind of like final stop before I return to the UK.
So I will admit I haven't read every single one of your blog posts from back then, but I'll go backwards and I'll go back and read that one, because I'm sure that one's brilliant, because I hadn't spotted the Faroese part.
Yeah, it was. I'm really lucky that I got to. And then at the very beginning of my at the very beginning of this huge cycle, I left home, said goodbye to my dad. My mum lives in Copenhagen, so I started that cycle around the world. I mean, at the time, I had no idea it would be that big a cycle. I was just trying to see how far east I could get. But I wanted to go and visit my mum in Copenhagen. So that was kind of the beginning of the journey. So it was quite nice that I had like a pit stop early on, you know, visiting family. And it was quite nice that, again, towards the very end, I also had a pit stop visiting family before going home.
And I noticed your mum also came out and visited you, like you were beach bumming with her. And was it in somewhere in Indonesia or was it in Thailand?
Yeah, that's right. She came and visited me in, in Thailand after not having seen her for probably a year and a half at that point. So we had a little very nice, relaxing beach holiday, catching up and most importantly, not doing any cycling at the time.
And I'm sure she's treating you as well.
She was.
I know that for a fact because we treated our son when he was doing stuff like that. Right. So let's get back to what we're meant to be talking about here, Jonathan, and that is Komoot. So before we do that, I mean, give us the history of Komoot because, you know, would you have used it on your... So this is 2015 to 2017, yeah?
Yeah, so I think unfortunately, I was a little bit too early. Komoot's been around, the app's been around for about a decade now, set up by six friends from Germany and Austria. They have, I guess they were kind of united by a love of both tech and also nature. They all come from the fringes of, you know, like, beautiful parts of Europe, but a very clever bunch, yeah, excited about like the future of tech and where it intersects with like, you know, all aspects of reality in our day-to-day lives. So Komoot is a German company, but and going back to your opening comment, it's a German company, but we consider ourselves very much a global or at least very European company. The people who work for Komoot are spread out across all of Europe. So we have quite an international outlook on the world, I would say.
And was that right from the beginning or was it very localized to begin with and then only gradually did it become international?
Definitely, it was a gradual thing. I think Komoot, I can't quite, it was before my time, the point, because Komoot's fully remote. So at one point switched and thought, well, why not sort of recruit from across an entire continent instead of one country? And for a good number of years, Komoot has been consciously international. So like had the app, the product translated to English a long time ago. We now have Komoot available in half a dozen languages. So like that obviously takes time and resources, but it's quite important for us to allow as many people as possible around the world to like understand and interact with the app. So in terms of my own journey in cycling, I was kind of a bit too early on in the process. It's quite funny actually. When I first left, I really was not a cyclist. In 2015, when I left home, it all came together very quickly. And this was sort of the blogging, the end of those blogging glory years, I think, around 2010 to the mid-teens. So anyway, I found some resources online and people were saying, oh, you can buy a cycling computer and use that. I didn't really have much cash at the time, so I picked the cheapest cycling computer that looked like it might do the job. And it was this this Garmin device. I can't quite recall what it was called. But you couldn't load base maps onto it. You could create a route somewhere and export a GPX file, and then you could have this line to follow it. And I was just following the North Sea coastline. On my way up to Scandinavia. And I spent a lot of time getting very lost. And after about 3 weeks on the road, I met someone who was like, you know, you can just use your phone for this. And I didn't have mobile data across Europe. It was like before, it was quite so easy to connect everywhere. But it hadn't even occurred to me that I could use my phone as a GPS device, that it had this functionality, which feels a bit silly in hindsight, but why would I have? I lived a sort of normal city life where I was always online at the time. And I hadn't realized that I could download these map files from OpenStreetMap. And so I could kind of work out where I was at all times. So when I had that revelation, it was kind of blew my mind, and things became a lot easier. And as we might discuss later, fast forward almost 10 years, it's now even easier than ever to have these good quality maps offline and also to sync them with devices. But it's funny to look at where Komoot is now compared to my very rudimentary experiences almost a decade ago.
So the first time I came across Komoot, in certainly seared into my consciousness, when my son was cycling back from China.
Yeah.
And I had all sorts of other ways of doing routes, but he was insistent that he was using Komoot. So all the way back from China, in some pretty hairy places, parts of the world, some of which I can see that you've cycled through as well, he was using Komoot. And I need to ask him why he was using it. But he did find it very valuable, and certainly very valuable in those hairy parts of the world, because it was drawing down some pretty okay maps, and it was giving him obviously really good information. So here's the pitch, Jonathan: why use Komoot? Why would world tourers use Komoot, and why would that non-world tourers want to use Komoot? Just bumbling around the Yorkshire lanes or the Norfolk coast. So why those two users might why they want to use Komoot?
That's really cool to hear that Josh used Komoot for that. I watched his video of that long journey. It's so amazing. And yeah, really nice that Komoot was able to help that a little bit. And I know that you've traveled a lot by bike as well. I think it's funny, Komoot. especially with bike touring, it's been around, it's been a thing for a very long time. It wasn't really that long ago that people were relying on paper maps. But that's in the same way that people used to, drive around with British people with an A to Z, in the car. And that already feels like such an outdated thing. I think a lot of very young people, it's probably a fact that a lot of young people don't know how to read maps in the same way that older generations do. So I would say for bike touring, it's kind of like, I sometimes think, why would you not embrace the technology that we have now? When I was cycling around the world, I did not really do any complex route planning on my phone. But now with Komoot and some similar apps and products, it's incredibly easy. The Komoot app is really intuitive. The algorithms are very sophisticated. It's very easy to find multiple options, but to find very suitable options from A to B, even in parts of the world where some of the map data is less comprehensive. And you can do all of this from your phone really easily. You don't have to drag paper maps around. You can very easily forecast how long it will take to get from A to B. You can very easily find out where might be a nice detour to take. There's just a lot less guesswork involved. So for the bike tourer, it's a really powerful tool. But I would also say for the recreational user popping around the local lanes in the British countryside, for example, or a beginner, we have a lot of tools that make it really easy to find a suitable route based on your ability. So while we have the route planner, which is great for finding A to B rides, whether that's 100 miles or whether that's 2,000 miles across a continent, for the casual users who are doing regular recreational loops, on our Discover interface, we have, within just a few clicks, you can find routes that are based on your preferred sport type, whether you're gravel riding or road cycling, if you like hilly routes or flatter routes, or whether you're a hiker as well, because we accommodate for hiking as well. So you have these options that are tailor-made for your needs within just a couple of clicks, and you can go, and someone who's cycling across a continent probably understands how maps work, probably enjoys looking at them, probably enjoys the process of stitching a route together. But for a lot of other users, that's not a priority for them. They just want to spend the time outside having a good time without anything to worry about.
There are a number of navigation apps, some of which seem to be very popular in North America, and some that are more popular in Europe. So that ecosystem seems to be very, very healthy. There are a number of apps going for the same kind of thing, you know, from, you know, including one-man bands like cycle.travel. So all of these different apps that are out there, how are people choosing? Do you think people are going through a list and they're going like, oh, I've tried that one, oh, I like this one? Or do you think they just find one and then they just keep on using that one come what may? How do you think this ecosystem works?
Gosh, that's a very good question and a very big question. I think for a lot of people, it's probably a question of what they used first. And that goes beyond just these like app-based kind of routing platforms. If someone is very used to using or has successfully used paper maps for decades, or if someone in the UK is, you know, swears by ordnance survey, and they've always had, you know, good experience doing that, they'll be unlikely to change unless you give them a very compelling argument or a good example. So I think a lot of people, what they first start using becomes the thing that they become familiar. Like, familiarity is so important. Same with a lot of like tech or products that we use day to day. We're quite hesitant to change our routines. I also think within that ecosystem, people's preferences probably change quite a lot based on if they have a bad experience as well. The same with all types of different, you know, products that we consume. You know, there's probably many things that you've used day to day for years, and suddenly when it breaks or something goes wrong, that you decide I want to try something different. And then I would also say the local element probably plays a significant part in it. You mentioned, you know, like other regions, or for example, North America, the market is in a different, like perhaps a different status for us, or, you know, different other products that are available for people. I think a lot of it depends on the local side of it is to do with your peers. So like who you explore with, you trusting your, you know, the recommendation of those you go out with, or the people who give you a great experience outdoors, but also whether or not the product is localized and translated into your language. That also makes a big difference. People find, rightly so, it's reassuring when the product is as easy to understand, gives a different level of trust. So I think those are a few of the factors that that kind of change the state of play. But overall, I would say that it's a good thing. There are a lot of incredibly bright minds and a lot of great innovative companies in a kind of overlapping space, often with a slightly different objective. And, you know, that's just great for the consumer because it means that we're all kept on our toes, constantly looking for ways to improve.
Those variety of companies out there, some are chosen by, for instance, you know, cycle travel companies. So when you're going on a cycle holiday, they will choose to partner with a navigation app company, and then they will send you all the routes on that. So you're basically you're almost tied in on that particular holiday to that particular navigation app. Good thing, bad thing. So is that something that it's incredibly important to discover who are actually giving these links out and work on them? Because, you know, you go on a North American owned cycle holiday company in, say, Italy, and even though you're in Europe, you're using, in effect, an American app because it's an American company that's leading those tours. So is that something that you as in Komoot, or your colleagues in Komoot, are actively trying to partner with these key companies?
Yeah, there are a lot of ways that we might sort of acquire new users, and by that I mean like reaching people and giving them their first experience on Komoot. Those kind of partnerships, I guess they probably represent like a smaller percentage of the ways to reach people, but that doesn't mean that they're not important, particularly because if that partner, whether it's a tour operator or, you know, a hotel, someone who's running a hotel, or even an event organizer, if they trust in Komoot, and, you know, I would say in Europe, you're far more likely to find that stuff, that information presented to you via Komoot than anyone else. That's great because it just reassures the, you know, the user that people look for that kind of reassurance from those kind of places of authority. So those partnerships are really important to us, and we do work with a lot of tourism organizations, maybe even like hotels, tour operators. We do have quite a lot of active partnerships, and it's great for us because we reach their audience, but it's really good for us. We put a lot of effort into the people that do choose to work with us on educational tools so that they understand Komoot inside out and can then give their users a good experience. And that remains like super important for any of those types of partnerships.
Because I noticed if you get a Brad guidebook, a cycling guidebook, and it's, you know, to the lanes of East Anglia or whatever have you.
Yeah.
Well, you're flicking through this book, and there's a little QR code. You open that up, and oh, there's your route in Komoot via the Brad guidebook. So what else have you got? Who else are you, apart from Brad, what else are you out there in like a published terms?
Well, that's a good question. Off the top of my head, I'm going to struggle to think of them, but quite a lot of, of course it's difficult because we are so, you know, like across the whole of the continent. There are some amazing publications and magazines that we've partnered with across, yeah, Germany, France, Italy, Spain. And I think one thing that's really nice at the stage that Komoot's at is, particularly within certain segments in Europe, it would almost be strange for the user to have the route presented to them in a different way, because they're so familiar with Komoot. That's what they use for their group rides. That's what they use for the events they sign up to. That's what they do for their day-to-day riding. And so a lot of those partners, like, they will present stuff on Komoot. Regardless, like, we'd always like to help them present their stuff in the best way possible, but they're still going to be reaching out and using Komoot simply because it's a really nice, easy way to share and present routes with your kind of users or participants.
And what do you do for Komoot? So what is the community part of your job title? What does that involve?
Yeah, so I'm the global community manager at Komoot. The global part is global, but it's in particular, it's about the gaps between. So we have a team of community managers spread out in some of the markets where we have more kind of community oriented stuff going on. We have more people. So there's a couple of two or three people in Germany. We have a couple of community managers in the UK. I'm kind of filling in the gaps between a lot of the markets that are growing for us, but aren't quite at the same kind of stage just yet. And then the community part of it is kind of two things. One thing is our external partnerships. So that could be with events and event organizers. That could be with the kind of inspiring individuals that we work with because they have, you know, a great platform, or they have a very inspiring story to tell, or they're great at motivating people that follow them. And then on the other side of that, I have a lot of focus, particularly these days, on our core community. So Komoot is, well, we're really lucky that we have such a huge audience. We've got about 37 million users. So there's a lot of people. And not all of those people are, you know, active every day or using Komoot to connect with other people and share their stories within the community. But we have millions of people who are, and I spend a lot of time, as do my colleagues, on how do we give these people, how do we reward them for their contributions? How do we motivate them to share more? How do we make sure that people are getting fed the right inspirational content based on their preferences? So elevating our kind of, and looking after our core community is also a significant part of my role.
So can you, as going slightly backwards into your background as well, and if you were going to set out on the kind of track that you started in 2015, and you're going to do that now, for instance, could you open up Komoot and say, you know, all right, do me a route from London all the way around the world back again, or do you have to do it in stages? How would you, if you were going to be doing it again, how would you use Komoot?
I think I think doing a route around the world probably possible, but that's an awful lot of information for for one file. So I would probably break it down to smaller segments, which is, to be fair, exactly what I did when I cycled around the world, and what most people probably would. So when I left home, and sometimes thinking about cycling around the world is quite kind of, it's overwhelmingly big kind of concept to navigate. But I would break it down into really small parts. So I knew that I wanted to cycle from London to Copenhagen. I knew that I wanted to visit a friend in Amsterdam, for example. So to begin with, I would focus on how do I get from London to Amsterdam. That's a kind of more sensible, you know, if you break it down to blocks, the whole thing becomes a lot more manageable, both in terms of logistics, but also mentally. So I would do the same on commute. One thing that sets commute apart from some similar platforms is that we have a variety of different sport types you can choose from. So if you go on the route planner, you'll see that even for cycling, there's a few variations. There's like road cycling, gravel riding, bike touring, mountain biking. And that's really important because, even within bike tourers, people have different preferences. If someone wants to get to Amsterdam in, you know, 2 or 3 days on a road bike, credit card touring, staying in hotels, they might want to be thinking, they want to have the mindset of a road cyclist. They want to choose quick, efficient routes. They're on 25 mil tires. They don't really want to be going down towpaths, no matter how they're graded. And so these different algorithms think slightly differently, which I think is really important. I would, for the way I was touring leisurely, I would be on the bike touring mode. But anyway, it's just important to point out that there's different types based on your kind of bike and your riding preferences. We have a tool called the multi-day tour planner. So I could pick from London to Amsterdam, and then I could divide it up into, let's say I want to do it in 4 days, or I know that I want to do about 6 hours of cycling a day. I can divide it up, and then it takes into account the elevation on the way. So I have like a kind of consistent breakdown, which is really helpful when you're trying to forecast when you might get to a certain location. The other tool that I would definitely would be using on the route planner, one of our features is the sport specific overlays, and then you can overlay the long distance or national cycle routes, which is super helpful. I do this and I'm always toggling between these, whether I'm out hiking or cycling. It just means at a cursory glance, I can see the long distance routes. So for example, I was at the time following loosely one of the Eurovelo, I can't remember which number it is, the one that goes up along that coast. Well, I can see that overlaid on the map. And so I can compare that against the route that I'm plotting. I can make sure that I'm like loosely following it. That makes a real big difference, both when I'm long distance touring or if I'm even just kind of out exploring in the south of England. So those are a few of the main tools that I would use. The final thing I would add, I wouldn't have such a rudimentary cycling computer. I would still have one. The Garmin that I have now is far more modern and has base maps. And we actually have an app designed for Garmin specifically. And with that, I can create the routes on my phone, and I can just press one button, send to device, and I can load up the IQ app on my Garmin device, and the route will just go bing, and here it is. And if I want to change my route halfway through the day, I can now just update it on Komoot on the app on my phone and press update, and I'll get a little notification and my route will be updated. So if I wanted to cut my day short or go to a different hotel or campsite in the evening. And that feature is so cool. And I think if I'd had that all those years ago, there would have been a lot less faffing involved, which would have been wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I used that the other day, in fact. So I had a Garmin unit and I was navigating with Komoot. I hadn't actually changed the route because I got off my bike at after 70 miles because the wind was about 50 miles an hour ahead of me. But still, I was using it and it was neat, that. So I agree. So the map, I mean, I've got the app open here now. And in other apps, you have a choice of quite a few maps. But here, I see the Komoot map, I see a satellite map, but then there's no like Ordnance Survey for the UK. So, because you're in, is that because you're an international brand and that's just one market?
Yeah.
So there's no point just offering an OS just for one market.
I mean, you could obviously you could argue for it, and in the UK, a lot of people aren't really familiar with and put a lot of trust into Ordnance Survey. Komoot's sort of core foundation revolves around OpenStreetMap. We are such committed believers of the OpenStreetMap project, and it's really at the core of everything we do. And we are constantly looking for ways that, you know, we can help to enrich the data that's there or help to, you know, facilitate improvements to it. You're right. I think because we are active in so many different countries, we could protect, we could try and add all of these different national maps, but the user experience would become quite convoluted. You know, if I travel a lot using Komoot, I quite like knowing that I can get my head around the Komoot render of OpenStreetMap, which is our like primary map, and then we have satellite map. I like being familiar with it. I like knowing that the sort of routing algorithms will give me consistent results in different places. And that's quite important to us, that we still give people like quite a, not simple, but like, you know, familiar user experience that doesn't become overwhelming or confusing for them. But we really, I should stress that we like, especially in the markets where we are most active in, the quality of the OpenStreetMap data is really amazing, and it's always improving. And it always is, yeah, enough for us to give people a really good experience.
Maybe this is an age thing then, because I mean, I grew up with OS maps. Maybe people of an, who are younger than me are not so hidebound. You know, as because you were saying before, you know, people are no longer using paper maps. If I've grown up as a user of paper maps, and yeah, I no longer use paper maps, but I use the Ordnance Survey maps on my phone. It generally tends to be, if I'm like trying to visualize an area, then me will, as somebody who has grown up with that kind of Ordnance Survey mind map, I would default to Ordnance Survey, as that's how I explain, you know, my where I am. So to me, that's like, well, I need OS to know exactly where I am. It's great to have the OpenStreetMap. It's lovely and the Komoot version of it, but still like, yeah, but where am I? And I need something that's very familiar. But that might just be, you know, people of an older generation. And that obviously to my son, to Josh, that had zero relevance. And he probably wouldn't know his way around an OS map, but he would know his way around, you know, the Komoot map really well. So do you think that's just, tell me, Jonathan, is this just me? Is it just me because I'm very, very old?
No, I'd be careful. I'd frame my answer as well.
Yes, be careful.
I think your Ordnance Survey specifically has a very particular place in the British sort of, well, the psyche of how we spend time out, how we map the country. It's, and there are equivalents in other countries. I'll give you an example, because I almost feel like as a outdoorsy person who likes going on adventures and is British and spends a lot of time exploring the British outside, I should be more familiar with Ordnance Survey. But I confess, I've grown up in London. I didn't kind of do much outdoorsy stuff at school. Honestly, I've never really used Ordnance Survey. I am when I started to explore, there were sort of these phone-based solutions available for me right away, sort of 10 years ago, revolving around OpenStreetMap. I do spend a lot of time hiking and walking for leisure, and I've just never found that I needed it. I'm super familiar with OpenStreetMap. I'm now an expert in how Komoot works. And so it's just funny. I think it's like different types of people for sure, especially in the UK. But I would say also globally, it's just very different, like different generations who've grown up, especially of the sort of, you know, even for example, with Google Maps is sort of omnipresent in our exploring of the world and navigating. I'm talking about everything now, from public transport to driving. And even like the sort of sat navification, I'm sure that's not a word, but how we drive a car around the world has now had a massive influence on people hiking and cycling. A lot of people would prefer to hike with turn-by-turn instructions on their phone and find that far more easy to get their head around than navigating from a paper map. And plenty of people could argue that that's not as good. But I think if you embrace, the quality of the map data, and you embrace that this actually helps a lot more people explore because there are less friction points or less obstacles for them to get over to get outside. I'm not sure that's necessarily such a bad thing.
And let's go slightly backwards in that the name commute, mm-hmm. obviously it's K-O-M-O-O-T, is a pun on commute. So when it was originally developed, was it an internal city thing? Or was it always, this is meant to explore the world with? Or was that explore the world with just something that came afterwards? And is the name a bit of a misnomer?
It is actually a bit of a misnomer, partly because it's actually like a commute derived from, I think it's called the Valsa dialect, which is the region that the founders are from. And it's just like, as far as I understand it, a casual greeting. It means something like simple and practical. And so it is actually slightly misleading because that's the origin of commute.
So it's nothing at all to do with commute.
Well, I'm not sure if it's a good or a bad thing that they're so similar, but that's the origin of the name commute. It doesn't, and the sort of the product and the philosophy doesn't come from commuting at all. It's about spending time outside. Of course, you could probably interpret that in many ways. Perhaps this is an alternative way of, commuting in nature. As it happens, many people use commute as part of their commute within town because they want to find a more scenic way of getting from A to B. But that's not that was never. The objective of the company, and still that isn't the case.
Right. Interesting. So I got that wrong then.
Well, I also had it wrong for a very long time. If that makes you feel better.
It does. Thank you very much.
I'm afraid now that you'll really struggle to pronounce commute without saying commute, because it's only a matter of time before that becomes a riddle in itself.
Mm. Well, of course, Google isn't, I think it's a mathematical term, isn't it? So it would have been familiar to some people, but most people it's not a familiar term. So it's just this unusual term. So anything that's slightly unusual is better for a website, name.
True.
So the fact that you're kind of spelling this and people think it means this, but it doesn't, but they remember it anyway. So that's the trick, just remembering it.
Yeah.
So if it helps some people to think, oh, that must be commute. Oh, yes, you spell it with a K. And if other people know it as a greeting in a certain language, that's also okay. So it's however you get your name remembered.
Yeah, very much so.
Mm. So at this point, Jonathan, I'd like to actually cut away and let my colleague take over, and we'll be back in a few minutes. So take it away, David.
This podcast is brought to you by Turn Bicycles. The good people at Turn understand that while a large cargo bike can carry oodles of stuff, many of us prefer something, a little more manageable. That's why they've come up with the HSDE cargo bike for folks with big aspirations to go car-free, delivered in a compact size. With its rear shock to 80 kilos and a combined hauling capacity of 180 kilos, the robust new HSD is stable and easy to maneuver, even when under load. And with its Bosch e-bike system, tested and certified to meet the highest UL standards for electric and fire safety, you'll be able to share many worry-free adventures with a loved one, whether it's your kiddo or Nan. Visit www.turnbicycles, that's T-E-R-N, turnbicycles.com to learn more.
Thanks, David. And we are back with Jonathan of Commute. We've discovered that it doesn't mean commute, unless you want it to mean commute. It can mean whatever you want. But Jonathan is, he's the community, global community manager for Commute. And he's if anybody's going around the world on their bicycle, or wanting to go around their world on the bicycle, and they're wanting to use Commute, then clearly Jonathan would be a good guy to learn from. and he's certainly in a pretty good job for the kind of company commute is. Because, Jonathan, you went around the world. Well, we have touched on this, but now let's explore this in greater detail. So we've got the commute bit out of the way. Let's talk about where you've come from and why you're working for commute. So we laughed before. Could you mention the fact that when you started, you weren't much of a cyclist? And I was kind of thinking, yeah, that's right, because of what the amount of kit you took to begin with is the kind of the classic. And I made this exact same mistake when I started my cycle touring adventures many, many, many years ago. You take too much kit. So you had an enormous amount of kit, and you had a kind of an old school bike. You were on steel. You were on a bicycle that I would have been familiar with in the 1980s, you know, a Dore Super Galaxy, the classic touring bike of a while ago. And then you clearly learnt a lot in that time that you're away. But you started, I mean, reading your blog, you basically picked this bike. You didn't seem to know much about cycling. And then like a week later, you're off touring the world. So describe, have I got that completely correct? You were pretty much a novice and then you went cycle touring around the world.
That is pretty much it. It's almost embarrassing to admit how little preparation or knowledge I had prior to leaving. But I think I was just blessed with youthful naivety at the time. And I didn't have high expectations at all. I just wanted an adventure. And there are very few simpler ways of finding one than grabbing a bike and kind of just heading off without a plan.
Oh, well, it's classic, absolutely classic, the way that kind of developed. But let's find out, what were you doing at the time? How long were you expecting to be? Did you have any plans at all? Were you literally trying to go around the world, but you didn't know how long it was going to take? Or were you just going to cycle and see where you got to and then just you might give up at some point? What were you doing? How old were you and what were you doing at the time?
So if I rewind a little bit further, we touched upon it at the beginning of the call. I grew up in London, but my father's British, my mother's Danish. We never cycled, or I never cycled for fitness. I never cycled for leisure or for exploring. However, I did grow up riding bikes. It was just very much like a functional tool to get around. London is not a bike-friendly city, but it's a very practical city to get around and maneuver by bicycle. So I grew up cycling. I studied music at university. When I returned to London, I wasn't entirely sure what to do next. Like, I'm sure plenty of young people in their early 20s have the same sort of existential crisis. I was quite fortunate that I'd been working the whole time I was studying, and while I had an awful lot of debt, I'd somehow ended up with you know, a few grand in the bank account saved up. So I kind of had this incredible, I was in this incredibly privileged position where I could kind of, yeah, go and explore a little bit without having to take the next more serious steps in life. I had always traveled a lot. That had been a high priority for me. I had done a bit of long distance walking. I was kind of prepared for another long hike, and then kind of had this moment, this epiphany, I suppose, where I thought, well, what about cycling? That could be, I was really interested in rather I was interested in overland travel. So I became kind of fixated by this idea of cycling and then bike touring. And these were, I think, a wonderful period on the internet where you could find all these incredible blogs that were so relatable and so inspiring and so informative as well. And so the sort of recommendations I found online, people said Dore Galaxy is a good bike, found one on eBay, bought it. What is a good pannier to take? Bought some Ortlieb panniers from Argos and got all of this around Christmas. And then I left 2 weeks later, and the plan at the time, I'd been sort of telling my peers and family I was going to cycle to Australia. But it was a pipe dream. But it was kind of a joke as well. It was a good way of like picking something so outlandish that people wouldn't take it seriously at all, which was fair enough given that I'd never cycled further than about 10 miles. And so I set off, as I said, to go and visit my mother. And I said, if this goes well, I will continue heading east, and I had a fantastic first month, and I continued riding to Turkey. I became very good at living, I would say, extremely cheap on the road. Realized that I could probably get quite a long way, and yeah, I ended up going all the way to Australia, by which point I was completely broke. But I got a job and worked for a few months there, and then at that point it became very clear to me that I wanted to continue and make it around the world cycle. And so I did that, and got home just under 3 years after having left, probably having clocked around 50,000 kilometers, which is kind of a mind-boggling number when I say it out loud.
Mm. Now, some people kind of do that in 3 weeks. Yeah. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but they do it fast. And you know, some commute users, Marcus Stitz, for instance, did it on a single track, et cetera, et cetera. But you took 3 years. Now, it's not to say you weren't doing some big mileages. You know, I read on your blog, you know, some days you're doing 145 kilometers, and then other days, clearly, you're just doing nothing because you're just enjoying the location. So you never had any plan to do it in a certain amount of time. You were just basically just ebb and flow. It was just whatever the life threw at you, you kind of did that.
Yeah, and thank goodness I approached it like that, because otherwise I think it would be overwhelming to think about. And those people who cycle around the world planning on it or trying to break records, I think it must just require so much, I don't know, thought and pressure. I really was just kind of going for a ride. There was never any pressure, no expectation. If I went home whenever I was bored, that would have been fine. No one would have judged me. So I was really making up as I went along. And when I left, I had absolutely no plan to spend anywhere near that long on the road, nor did I have any plans to cycle all the way around the world. I am a tourer at heart. Cycling at that pace is, and I've done a lot of more sort of, I don't know, extreme bike packing. I've done a lot of ultralight cycling. I've even tried a few ultra endurance races, but touring at that kind of pace for me is just the most kind of beautiful ratio in life.
Mm. So I noticed you've done the Transcontinental. So you have done these races, but your forte is basically just tootling along.
Definitely. And if I continue my cycling trajectory in between cycling around the world and ending up doing what I'm doing currently at Komoot, when I returned home, having spent all of this time on the road, I actually worked as a bicycle courier in London for a short period, which was, there's no better way to recalibrate and reintegrate into city living, having spent so much time on the road, than to get paid to cycle around delivering stuff and exploring, you know, a city, even if it's your home city, by bike. And I then started working at a company called Apidura. And I know that you're familiar with Apidura because I believe you interviewed the founder of Apidura, Tori, on this mm-hmm. podcast a few years
ago. Yeah.
And I was there for a few years, and that was really, I mean, it obviously made sense. I had a lot of touring experience, but that was in 2018, which was really when this hugely significant kind of shift in interest from bike touring to bike packing, which you can interpret in many ways, but this shift was really kind of about to explode and then get even more exaggerated through the pandemic. So I had learned so much about traveling by bike, and then I learned so much about the benefit of ultralight cycling and these new packing systems that were so different to taking four panniers on a loaded bike. And so, yeah, I spent 4 years at Apidura, did the roller coaster that was COVID-19, and that was sort of the segue that led me to Komoot, because Komoot has been so involved with you know, bike packing as an established but also an emerging sport in the last few years.
Because looking at your bike setup back then with the Galaxy and the bags you had on, that was very much old school. Yeah. And that I can completely identify with that, because I'm clearly old school, and that's where I started. So, you know, four panniers at least, loads of stuff, and carrying too much, et cetera, et cetera. And you look at that now and you think, No, you would have the Apoduro style. You know, you'd have the bike packing bags. You probably wouldn't be carrying quite so much kit. Although some of the places you went to, you know, I'm thinking of like your Australia video and stuff, where you're obviously having to pack. I mean, when you're going across the desert, you're having to pack, you know, enormous amounts of water. You've got to have all of the bug kit. You know, you've got to have all of the stuff that's protecting you from the nasties. So sometimes you have got, no matter how many, it's not an old school versus new school thing. It's just you have to have a lot of kit in some places. And there's no two ways about that. You know, even if you're doing a transcontinental style, you know, fast route across somewhere, you'd still need a fair bit of kit. But when you started out, actually a good point. Did you finish on the same bike?
I did. I finished on the same bike, and I still ride that same Dawes Galaxy as my day-to-day pub runaround bike.
Excellent. But it's like Trigger's broom. You've got, you know, you've replaced tons of things, or it's still largely the same bike.
It's the same frame. It's the same fork, and that is all that remains of the original bike.
Mm. So that's pretty good going. Well done, Dawes Super Galaxy.
Yeah, there's a lot to be said. I think modern bikes are so reliable in general. But yeah, I'm very much of the Steel fan club. That bike has a lot of battle scars from various sort of unfortunate collisions with other vehicles or just the road or ice. But it's still, it's still going strong. And you're right, I've been very lucky to experience traveling by bike in very different forms from the kind of old school bike touring sense where you carry basically your entire house, to super ultra light, you know, bike travel where you just have a bivy bag and you sacrifice all levels of comfort. I've also done a lot of off-road sort of mountain bike touring. I think the thing that I find so wonderful about bicycle travel in general is that there's always a new way to do it, and there's absolutely no right or wrong way of doing it. I think it's very easy to get caught up in the idea of, I must be a lightweight bike packer, or I must do it in this particular way. But really, there's no right or wrong way of doing it. We're all very different. We all travel for very different reasons, and there's different ways of packing for it. And even if I refer back to commute and the way that we're set up, we give people the tools to pick, you know, they can pick the fast road route if they want, or they can pick the meandering route. They can pick the most direct one, or they can pick the most leisurely one up and over the mountains. I think this whole kind of space is really set up for the user to be able to customize, you know, what they're doing and how they're carrying it based on what their objectives is. And I think that's what's, really kind of charming about the whole two-wheel travel thing.
Hmm. See, I'm a historian of many things, but including cycling. And Thomas Stevens, if I don't know if you've come across that name in the past, but he was a big wheel rider. So what people would call penny farthings. And this is 1880s. And the kit he had, the amount of kit he had and how it was packed is very much like bike packing. You know, it's the big pannier bags, that's pretty much a 70s and 80s thing, you know, really, really old. And I was calling that old school, but genuinely old school. So 1880 stuff is, you know, Apidura style, incredibly lightweight, hardly carrying anything at all kind of touring. So that's kind of where cycle touring started. Yeah. And we've kind of come full circle in many ways. And so people are going out there with incredibly minimal bits of kit and somehow surviving. So when you did your circumnavigation and you had all this enormous kit, were you jettisoning bits as you were going along and just thinking, you don't really need this? So you became an expert just because you're having to carry this stuff. And because you're having to carry it, you quickly learn, I don't need that, chuck it.
Yeah, and I did get rid of an awful lot of stuff. I had some very questionable belongings with me. Like I had I was on quite a budget when I left and while I was going, so I would sort of just wouldn't mind sacrificing bit of weight for a cheaper option. But I had like my mother's old coat, which was this like not anything resembling a down jacket, this monstrous thing that took up half a pannier. I had a pair of jeans with me to wear like when I was off the bike. It's the most unpractical kind of clothing. I think I even had like a sort of smart casual shirt that I thought I would like to dress up like a non-bike person when I was in town for a weekend. Or things that I would never do now. And I did get rid of a lot of this stuff slowly. And as time went on, I kind of improved things a bit as they broke. But then there was a lot of things that I wouldn't change. Like I traveled with, I mean, I had like a cutting board with me so that I could chop vegetables up when I was camping. And I had little film canisters filmed with spices and a proper saucepan so I could like eat well. And I wouldn't, again, a lot of bike packers would turn their nose up at that and think, God, this person's just sort of like a moving kitchen. But I, you know, for such a long period on the bike, I wouldn't change that at all. And I know that the sort of, especially at the moment with the sort of influence that bike packing has had on taking existing cyclists and making them realize what they can achieve on the bike. I still am a big believer in taking a bit more stuff. If your legs can handle it and if you're not in a hurry, you know, riding up a mountain with the extra weight on your bag, it's not going to do your fitness any disservice if you can get up it. I think a bit of comfort is quite okay. And while in general I'm a minimalist these days, I think there's plenty of space for carrying a few extra luxury items whenever you're traveling.
But did you come back, not you, but did the bike and the kit come back a lot lighter? So by the time you'd finished, because I know you'd have to badmouth the bags that you had, but you certainly changed your bags halfway round because of various reasons. And I noticed on your blog, you do kind of say a few choice words about the brand you had. But did you come back a lot more lightweight than you went? Honestly, much more lightweight.
I would say I might have shaved off like a kilo. Like in general, I pretty much had the same amount of stuff with me. And yeah, it couldn't have bothered me that much because otherwise I would have gotten rid of an awful lot of stuff. So no, I actually think I returned with a fairly similar amount of weight on my bike.
That's interesting because that's totally opposite to the way I did it. So when I started out, I had so much kit. I had like a wooden hammer for hammering in the tent pegs. I had, it's like, well, you just get a rock. You know, I had so many things that I was chucking stuff out, you know, from a very, very start. But you kind of quickly got used to, you know, what was necessary and what wasn't. And you don't know that until you're actually on the road. So I was ended up with a lot less kit. So I taught myself minimalism just because, whereas you're saying it doesn't matter, you can just pedal it up the hill. I was the opposite. I was like, no, I'm now, you know, the Crane brothers famously, when they went up Kilimanjaro and their stuff, they would, you know, drill holes in toothbrushes. I was never that extreme, but I would definitely want to be lightweight as much as possible. And so I am kind of interested in taking a chopping board. So I wouldn't have done that. But this is interesting about how different people approach these things. And like, I have come down to the minimalist and carrying such a little, and like, I wouldn't personally, not even going on like a, you know, a camping trip now, I won't take cooking equipment, for instance. I will generally buy what I need and eat that and then have to then scrabble to get, you know, fresh supplies. And I know it's much more efficient to take rice and what have you and then be able to boil this up. But to me, just carrying any amount of cooking equipment, to me, in my head, just that's too much weight. I can do this much lighter. And clearly, you're not. You're a different... Each to their own, isn't it? It's just different people want to do different things. And that's fine.
Definitely. And we need to make sure that we always sort of accommodate that because people are so different. And I think it's difficult, you know, in like, for example, in the cycling industry, it's a consumer-driven industry. We need to convince people, brands need to convince people that they need to do things in a different way or a better way or an improved way. But really, all of it comes down to like giving people the options so they can do things in the way that they want to do it. And, you know, there is absolutely no reason why one type of bike traveling is superior than another. They are, yeah, completely different ways of doing things for different people. So whether people navigate in one particular way, if they choose one kind of route, it's not about that. It's about giving people the options. And the same, like if someone wants to go on a road bike really fast with nothing on their bike, that's totally fine. And if someone wants to chuck four massive panniers on their bike, they'll probably be a bit slower, but that's but that's totally okay.
Mm. And so what are you doing now, John? What how would you describe your riding and your adventuring now?
I still try and when I travel, I always want to be on a bike. If I'm not on a bike, I've probably compromised a little bit. But I also like spending time walking around, being a normal person, especially if I'm on holiday with my girlfriend. But I do try and have one or two bike trips, big bike trips a year. Over the last few years, I've developed a sort of real love for exploring, I guess, capturing the essence of a big adventure closer to home. But in general, I'm sort of a casual cyclist. I like to get out for a proper ride every once a week if I can. I think working at Komoot is is wonderful, but a bit dangerous for someone like me who enjoys spending time looking at maps, because the list of places to visit is ever growing. But Komoot has this amazing interface. We had this route planner, which is wonderful, gives people all these advanced tools to make informed decisions about where they're going and how they get there. But we also have this Discover interface where you can have these created routes for you based on your sort of parameters, these kind of smart solutions. And that's had a really big impact on me since we launched it last year. I'm much more inclined to take a train out from London to a random station and say, load it up on Komoot and say, hey, I'm in a new area. I've got 3 hours. Give me something. So while I'm going on less epic adventures, I'm finding new kind of creative ways of exploring familiar places. I'm doing that a lot at the moment, and I'm extremely excited about doing more of that as the weather improves.
And is that a curated thing or is that an algorithm thing?
So it's a kind of a combination of stuff. Komoot, we have so much user data because we have millions and millions and millions of users. The number of recorded tours is kind of such a big number. It's kind of hard to get your head around. So we're able to give people these like personalized suggestions. So I can take the train out if I'm with, I don't know, if I'm with friends going out for a walk at the weekend. I can look at which train line takes me to a village that looks somewhere scenic. I don't own a car, so I can just say, I'm at this station. It will see where the people who use Komoot are heading when they record their tours. So it's very easy to get a feel for where people actually walk, where do people go for their recreational weekend strolls, and it will give me a clever or suitable solution to get kind of onto that, navigate the route, and then return to the train station. And it's incredibly clever how it works. If I go on where I live now and say I want to go for a four-hour cycle starting from where I live, I've lived in London for a long time and I've cycled in London for a long time. I know what all of the common roadie routes are that people take, whether they're going off to Windsor or Kent or Surrey, Essex. And if I let Komoot do this for me automatically, it's kind of amazing how it basically gives me the routes that people most commonly do. But it won't just give me 3 or 4 options. It will give me hundreds of options, which means that I can go out for a new ride and I can always find something that's slightly different to what I've done in the past. And I find that really inspiring for my like motivation to explore.
And then if you were in Iran, would it do the same? Or does it need that, you know, lots and lots of people have done this before? Or can it just go, oh, 3 people have done this. Okay, that'll be the route we curate for this person who's just ended up in Iran, for instance, exactly. Such as yourself a few years ago.
Yeah, you need to have the user data because it's based on what people actually do. So if we didn't have that, it wouldn't. We only want to do it when we're confident we give people a good experience. Otherwise, no one benefits from it. You can obviously still use the route planner and make your own tour in Iran. What I would say, in certain regions where there is less user data, we have an editorial team that make it there. We create the content. So we'll find what are the classic like walking routes based on like a variety of sources. We have an extensive editorial team that will add this content, and they will add suitable highlights, which is what we call the contributions that the community creates to add onto the map. So that this is an amazing viewpoint. This is a great cafe to stop at if you're a cyclist. This is a really beautiful ridgeline stroll. So we'll help to populate the map so that the people who are, it's a kind of a circular thing. The better the map data is, the better that the contributions are on Komoot, the more local people will find, have a good user experience. And then the more they use Komoot, the more they'll contribute. And that's how we kind of launch in new places where there's less of an active community, if that makes sense.
Yes, you're heat mapping then, in effect. So you're working out where people are going. And you see, perhaps your fellow app, this ecosystem we talked about before, maybe you know where people are cycling, you know, like the Strava type heat map.
Exactly. So we can, I mean, it's all obviously like, it's only when people choose to share stuff publicly, it's all like completely anonymized. But, you know, we have so much data, we're just trying to harness it. And yeah, so we do know where people cycle. We have that information, that's great. It's quite hard to sort of digest. But if you can take that and turn it into something actionable, the end result for the user is that they can say, I'm a beginner, I've got 2 hours, I've got a new phone mount to go on my handlebars, I can select this tour, I can just press go, and I can head off and have an amazing bike ride for 2 hours. And we can be really confident that it's going to be suitable, because that's what other people are doing when they, for example, select bike touring as a sport type. And the same for hiking. People won't be walking down the road, because we'll only be looking at data that's come from hikers. It's an incredible solution. It's very clever. And I think it's just a great way of mobilizing people, whether they're like really experienced cyclists who are just looking for something new and are bored of doing the same kind of loop over and over again, or newbies who need their hand held a little bit and want to have a solution that they can just go off and do with 5 minutes of planning instead of an hour of planning for a 2 hour excursion.
Now, right now, the bike, and I don't know how much you know of this, but the bike industry, certainly in the UK and in many other places in the world, is suffering, just incredibly bad. It is dire out there at retail. It's dire out there for suppliers, you know, post-COVID. We've basically just got a huge, huge lull, a complete slump. I did a story on Forbes the other day talking about how it's a 40-year low in the UK. You know, the last time we were as low as this in bike sales was in 1985. So 39 years, and that's pretty poor. Do you recognise that? Is that something you can look at and say, oh, people aren't riding as much? Or is that just purely at retail and people are still riding, they're just not buying?
It's a good question. I actually saw that Forbes article and it's definitely bleak reading, but I've worked in the bike industry for a number of years. It's like, I know many people who share the same kind of anecdotal experiences that things are changing. It is a problem with retail, and definitely like of these hangover kind of effects from the pandemic that's still making it really hard for people to forecast well. And it's just been so unpredictable for a few years now. Komoot is lucky because we don't deal with a physical product, but we are subject to the same kind of, you know, these kind of cultural shifts, whether people are collectively interested in exploring or cycling. We're not immune to that. We might not have the same issues that a bike manufacturer has, but we still get impacted by the same changes. And it's hard for us to predict these major shifts in usage in the same way that it's hard for anyone in the cycling industry. One thing that I think is great for Komoot, well, I think partly compared to a lot of physical stuff in the cycling space, it's quite an affordable price point and you can do an awful lot for free. So that's less of a barrier when people have less disposable income. We are international. So if one, you know, we're active in plenty of markets, but we are, I guess, subject to like international shifts in usage rather than, you know, locked in and reliant on one particular place. And also, we have a product that is set up for different sport types. So we can, you know, we're not sort of reliant on, we're not just a road cycling company. So if people overnight decide they're not interested in road cycling, that would be very unfortunate. It would be a very sad thing. But we have plenty of other, you know, markets and user types. And even within road cycling, for example, there's people who've been, you know, people who've been road cycling for many years in Italy decide to stop. Well, there's an entire, you know, there's millions of people who are maybe new to the sport or could become interested in the sport if you approach them in the right way. So, yeah, it's particularly in the UK, it's quite a bleak landscape at the moment. But I think Komoot's quite lucky in where we are positioned. We're not completely, stuck in the middle of that.
Mm. So, tell us how much it costs to go for the pro version and what you get with the pro version better than just going for the free version.
Sure, I will try and do a concise summary of our pricing. You can do an awful lot on Komoot for free. You can find these routes that I referred to in our Discover section. You can build our own routes. A lot of the functionality is there for free users. And when you sign up, you get a free region bundle so that you can explore a particular region. And these region bundles, you can either perch like an individual region. So like London, perhaps, would be one. That's going to be like a one. Those are all like one-time purchases. So you can buy a region for $3.99. Region bundle, a collection of them for $8.99, or you can get the whole world pack for $29.99. It's the same whether it's pound sterling, euros, or USD. And when you have a region unlocked, you can then use offline maps. So you can download the map, or you can follow the tour without needing internet. You also get voice navigation. And you also get turn-by-turn navigation, whether you're doing it on your phone or on your cycling computer or smartwatch. So those are all one-time purchases. And then we also have a premium like pricing tier, which is $4.99 a month, $59.99 for the year. And then with premium, you get a whole host of extra features and functionality. You get the whole world available offline. So those features that I mentioned earlier, you get all of that included. You also are able to make collections, which means you can group together either your planned tours. By that, I mean like the planned routes that you want to do, hiking or cycling, or ones you've completed. So like if I cycle around the world, I could add all of the daily bits into one nice collection to show, look, mum, see how far I've cycled while I was away. You also get sport-specific overlays, which I referred to earlier. So you can overlay the like long-distance hiking or cycling routes. You get on-tour weather, which is really cool. You can see where you're estimated to be when the sun sets or when the rain arrives, or the wind's looking like. You get live tracking. You get the multi-day planner, which I also referred to earlier. So if you have a really long route, you can divide it into like segments and add accommodation stops for each daily part. And finally, you get 3D maps. So they're all a bunch of features that are really amazing, really cool. I guess we pitch it as for people who want to go further. So people who require a little bit of extra features. And we're constantly trying to add new features to enrich that.
Great. So to wrap up, give us a URL. I mean, it's reasonably obvious. I've even spelled it out during the recording. Now, however, give us a URL, and then the URL for where people can. I mean, I'll obviously put it in the show notes, but where people can follow your your adventures in 2015 through to 2017, and then you've done subsequent rides and you're updating your blog for a while. So basically, give us your URL for the blog and for Komoot.
So Komoot, you can find, we're going to spell it out one more time for luck. It's just K-O-M-O-O-T, Komoot.com. On the web browser, you can also find the app on both iOS and Android if you want to give it a go and get started. Myself, you can find me on LinkedIn. If you can manage to spell my surname, you can add it into the podcast notes. I have a link there to my Komoot profile, should you be interested in following my adventures there. My blog is called JKB's Bike Ride, which is JKBS, my initials. If you want to read some of my rambling thoughts from a long time ago, all my photography from the many bike trips I've been on. And if you find me there, you can find me on other social media platforms. And I would just say, if anyone listening has any questions about the things that we've discussed today, or any questions about Komoot or bike touring, travel in general, you're very welcome to send me an email at jonathan@komoot.com. Always happy to hear from people and talk about adventures.
Jonathan, that's excellent. Thank you very much. Now, as expected, this was meant to be about Komoot. It was Komoot and Jonathan. It was like there's have to measure exactly how much is how much was Komoot and how much was Jonathan. But I kind of expected that. As soon as, you know, I wanted to interview you, then it's like, okay, we're going to be talking about bike touring. And we'll bring in Komoot here and there. So that hopefully, I mean, you were very clever. You were dragging Komoot back in as much as possible, which is absolutely fine. And good, because that's what ostensibly what we're meant to be talking about. Anyway, that's been fascinating. And thank you ever so much for we recorded this and it was an hour and 16 minutes and it flew by. So Jonathan, thank you ever so much.
That was a real pleasure. I really enjoyed, I really enjoyed going through whole range of subjects with you.
And I could have gone blog by blog posting by blog posting and tell me about the flies here in Australia and stuff, but we didn't. But I do recommend people go read your blog, look at your videos, and work out whether do you really want to cycle around the world, or maybe Jonathan's bug experiences and farting monks and stuff will actually inspire you to go and do your own stuff. So anyway, thank you very much.
That's a good teaser. Yeah, thank you very much for your time, Carlton.
Thanks for listening to episode 348 of the Spokesman Cycling Podcast, brought to you in association with Turn Bicycles. Show notes and more can be found at the-spokesman.com. The next episode will be a chat with Tom Knights of Strava Metro. That show will be out next weekend, but meanwhile, get out there and ride.